12 white ceramic tart cups, which she also brought to the island. She refreshed her drink and offered to refresh theirs. When Pogo accepted a second round, St. Croix smiled at him the way a fox smiled at a tender rabbit. Bartending finished, the fastidious baker washed her hands at the sink. She moved always as though she assumed she was being watched with erotic interest. When she returned to the island and began pressing buttery pastry dough into the tart cups, she twinkled her blue eyes at Pax and said, "Now, what is it you want to know about Ms. Bebe Blair? Were her parents drunk, doped up, or just tacky when they gave her such a frivolous name? Never mind, sorry. You're the one who needs to ask questions." Pax wondered at her quick and unqualified acceptance that they were something they had never claimed to be, that she deduced from a seal tattoo and little else that they had some law enforcement role and an official mission. Perhaps the days were long gone when college professors built their courses with respect for logic and reason, and likewise conducted their lives with that same respect. "Well," Pax began, "as you might imagine, we're most interested in why Ms. Blair was thrown out of the university writing program." Raising her eyebrows, St. Croix said, "Nowhere is it written that she was ejected for any reason. The story is that she resigned of her own volition, perhaps because she found the coursework too difficult, or the atmosphere of academic excellence not to her taste. Who can know but her?" Pax smiled, shook his head. "Give us some credit for exhaustive backgrounding, Doctor. We know from various sources that there must have been something more to it. And we suspect that whatever she did to get herself forced out back then is an example of the behavior that makes her of such great interest to us now."
"Exactly,"
Pogo said, apparently concerned that he might seem superfluous and therefore suspicious. St. Croix's attention was less on Pax and Pogo than on forming tarts. "I gave a writing assignment. The students were to choose someone they knew, but whose residence they had never visited. The person could be another student, a university staff member, or one of their instructors. This was to be a test of their powers of observation and psychological insight, as well as their sense of characterization and their imagination. Each student was asked to create a richly detailed, vividly described, coherent, credible living environment for that person, whether it might be a dorm room or an apartment or a house. Ms. Blair chose me for her subject."
"Were you bothered by that?"
"Not at all. I'd put myself forward as an acceptable subject. I expected any student who chose me to have some fun with it. I am not thin-skinned. When Ms. Blair turned in her piece, I wasn't surprised that she described the first two floors of this house with accuracy. There had been lovely parties here, quite wonderful occasions, when faculty members and students of previous classes had gathered in a unique atmosphere, both celebratory and intellectual. No, I wasn't surprised. But I was disappointed that she'd clearly sought out some of those people and grilled them about the layout of the house, the decor, the smallest of personal touches. This was supposed to be a creative exercise, not repertorial. Her descriptions were splendid. Her writing, unusually colorful and nuanced for a girl her age. But it was nonetheless something of a cheat to do what she'd done. Then, as I continued reading, much to my shock, I discovered that it was more than cheating. It was a crime." St. Croix focused so intently on forming the tart shells that when she fell silent, Pax realized she must be using the task at hand to direct her energy away from the anger that, when expressed, made her look years older and hard and unappealing.
"Crime?"
he asked.
"What crime?"
Finishing the fifth cup, the professor said, "Burglary. Well, to be scrupulously fair, no, not burglary. She didn't steal anything, so far as I could tell. They call it housebreaking, She came into my house, uninvited, when I wasn't here, and she roamed every corner of it, all the way through the third floor, which is not, and never has been, open to most of my guests. It was a monstrous violation of my privacy. My third floor is sacrosanct. Pax knew that Bibi wasn't capable of such a thing, but of course he didn't leap to her defense. He only glanced warningly at Pogo. After sipping her drink, St. Croix met Paxton's eyes. "Why are you called a chief petty officer? There's nothing petty about you, so far as I can see."
"Oh, it's just the Navy's quaint way of differentiating between commissioned and non-commissioned officers, so we don't forget our place in the scheme of things."
"So we don't get uppity,"
Pogo said, proving that he had no talent for either deception or interrogation. Pax expected that his answer to St. Croix's question might make her wonder if such a minor officer would likely be dispatched on an official mission in the civilian sphere. But then he realized from her half-smile and the directness of her gaze that the woman hoped to let him know the door was open for a more personal conversation and anything to which it might lead. He asked,
"How did Ms. Blair force entry? Break a window, bust a lock?"
"No evidence of how," said the professor, "which is what made it so unsettling. Clearly, she obtained a key. I was mystified as to how she could have done that, but I changed all the locks."
"You're certain she had a key?"
After taking another sip of her drink, St. Croix returned her attention to the pastry dough and the tart cups, making no further eye contact as she continued. "I am a strong and complex woman, Chief Petty Officer. I contain multitudes, as the poet said. I would have to be complex with considerable depths to have achieved my level of success and renown in the viciously competitive worlds of academia and literature, where the only sport more popular than log rolling is character assassination." She fell silent once more, and Pax knew better than to press her. After she finished forming the sixth chart shell and started on the seventh, St. Croix said, "Image is everything in the world I inhabit. I guard my image as fiercely as other people might guard their families, their fortunes, their sacred honor, if they believe there is such a thing. I am the founder of the most successful writing program in any university in the country. I am known to have an unerring eye for genius and the ability to nurture it. Certain of my former students have been invited to join the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Three have won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, two have won the National Book Award, and two have won Pulitzers. The lesser awards are too numerous to recount. I am a star maker. For someone in my position, an image of Spartan dedication to the written word at the expense even of my personal life, a reputation for cool indifference to everything but excellence in literature, makes me a laudable eccentric and an icon. My eminence wouldn't be materially affected even if I publicly acknowledged that a few of the most renowned graduates of my program are pretentious fools of little talent. But with a woman as complex as I am, there are aspects of my personality that wouldn't be regarded as compatible with my public image, and would, in fact, diminish it greatly. Therefore, I keep those interests strictly private, and indulge them only beyond the view of those who would be offended by them." Pogo sat goggle-eyed, as if his imagination were afire with images of her forbidden pursuits, as if he had forgotten that one of the controversial aspects of her personality that she felt the need to conceal was nothing more than an enchantment with Victoriana, the style and literature and perhaps the values of that age. "Miss Blair," the professor continued, "wrote her little document of extortion as if imagining that I were a woman of more facets than a well-cut diamond. She wrote of my third floor as if she found its secrets charming, and my unadvertised interests proof of the depth of my spirit and intellect. But of course, that was butt-kissing, meant to disguise her attempted blackmail. She was demanding my praise, my mentoring, my endorsement of her talent, my power to make her a star in return for her silence. Pax dared to say, "What if she was never in your house? What if she only accurately imagined your private interests?" Looking up from the tart shell, St. Croix regarded him with the pity of the intellectually anointed for those doomed by genes or by circumstance to ignorance. No one has an imagination of such power, of such intuitive genius, to know with accuracy what occupies a place in which she's never set foot. Her rich description of my third floor was as repertorial as what she wrote about the first two. Not fiction, but sleazy journalism. 95% on the mark. Hell, 98! The little bitch was there. She must have taken notes. That is a part of my life that I treasure to the extent that I rarely share it. The bed I sleep in most nights is on the third floor, not in my bedroom on the second. Only a trusted few have ever shared it with me, and none of them would have risked his relationship with me to conspire with that brazen, grasping little slut. Without being consciously aware of what she was doing, the professor had formed the seventh tart and then had torn it apart as if she were rending her former student's throat. She threw down the mangled dough in disgust, wiped her hands on the dish towel, and resorted to her glass of scotch and cream. If her equilibrium wasn't restored by the drink, at least she realized that in her ranting, she hadn't given them a clue as to the nature of the secret enthusiasm she indulged on the third floor. She couldn't know that they had read Bibi's writing assignment, so she could only suppose that they were imagining every perversion from bondage with violent flagellation to animal sacrifice. Their wonderment appeared to amuse the professor, for her face let go of the anger that stiffened it, grew soft with coquettish intent. She licked a milky smear from her lips and said, "If you would like to verify my accusations against Ms. Blair, I'll let you read a copy of her piece, and then take you up to the third floor to see for yourselves." Chapter 105. The Passenger. Spitting out wordless expressions of malevolent determination, the unseen creature seemed to have squirmed under the front passenger seat, trying to negotiate the adjustment tracks and the substructure, intent upon making its way into the forward footwell, from which it might more easily spring upon her. Unwilling to abandon the car to proceed on foot through this strange and hostile night, Bibi pulled the pistol from under her blazer and drove with only her left hand, which required her to let the Honda's speed drop. If not cast back in time to that fearful night before her sixth birthday, she was at least cast back in spirit. There is no adult terror equivalent to what an innocent child experiences when first confronted with the truth that evil isn't merely a figment of fairy tales, that it walks the world in countless forms, and that what it seeks most aggressively is the destruction of the innocent. With such an experience, childhood ends, regardless of the age at which that awful discovery is made. Bibi tasted again the metallic flavor of the first knowledge of evil, felt the childhood terror thrumming in her veins, her heart slamming as if it would either break the breastbone that armored it or hammer itself apart. The sense of helplessness that she had endured on that long-ago night was intolerable now, a condition to which she would not allow herself to be subjected, not after all these years of striving to put behind her the primal, forgotten horrors of her youth in favor of the ordinary fears and threats of a normal life. No, she said. Hell no, no, this cannot happen, will not happen, is not happening. Even though the writhing, twitching, wretchedly graceless thing had been real in the bungalow bedroom, it wasn't real here. She had killed it that night, whatever it had been, killed it by a means that she couldn't remember. 17 years later, it couldn't return to torment her. It was of another place and time. It couldn't possibly materialize like a ghost to haunt her now. The thing thrashing under the passenger seat, calling to her in phlegmy, knotted syllables, with less meaning than the cries of any animal, was only another variation of the thing that had knocked on the motel door, tapped on the motel window. A distraction, like the fog and the spirits in the house from which the girl had been kidnapped, like the man in the hoodie and the golden retriever that had tried to lure her away from the search for Ashley Bell. Like Chubb Coy, the chief of hospital security. What did he have to do with any of this, except to serve as a distraction, to thwart her by misdirection? He showed up at Norm's, at breakfast with St. Croix. Later, popped into the professor's Victorian retreat to kill her when she might have been about to make an important revelation, alluding to Flannery O'Connor and Thornton Wilder and Jack London, with whose work he was no more likely to be familiar than he was likely to be a master of particle physics. Suddenly, a truth about Chubb Coy circled Bibi. Circled like a night bird gliding the darkness with a keen eye on its prey. The same truth from which she had recoiled earlier. The truth that she had burned with the memory trick. She drove with her left hand, the pistol clutched in her right, weaving along the lonely highway, her heart seeming to jump, 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 rather than merely beat. Frenzied convulsions in her chest, and she thought, he didn't quote those books because he wanted to. He quoted them because I made him do it. That wasn't the truth that she rendered ashes in the motel sink, but it was somehow a funhouse mirror reflection of that truth. She didn't understand how she could make Chubb Coy do anything. That made no sense. She kept replaying the curious thought, trying to understand it. But instead of gaining clarity with repetition, it lost coherence, until she abruptly realized that the thing under the passenger seat, the unwanted passenger, had been silent for some time. Chapter 106. A Father's Intuition. Room 456. Sunday afternoon, 3:29. Blue sky beyond the window, sun westering but not yet declining in a red swoon. On the EKG screen, the girl's heart rate spiking, the sound switched off but the trace line pumping, pumping faster. On the EEG, 5 brainwave indicators all tracking optimal patterns simultaneously, as every neurologist knew was not possible. Nancy sat near the window, holding a newspaper that she hadn't requested, but that she had accepted from a well-meaning young candy striper, seeming to read it but never turning from the front page to the second. Perched on another chair with his smartphone, Murph checked the surf conditions in Australia. Byron Bay and Narrabeen and Torquay and Point Danger. Then on to Bali, wave height at Kuta Reef, Nusa Dua, Padang Padang, mainland Mexico at Mazatlan and San Blas. Todos Santos in Baja California and Scorpion Bay, Durban in South Africa and Cape St. Francis. He wouldn't be surfing any of them today, probably never. He kept checking anyway. Pipeline and Sunset and Waimea on the north shore of Oahu. Honolulu Bay and Ma'alaya on Maui. He felt that he was losing his grip on sanity, sliding slowly into a defensive kind of madness. Between Hawaii and Uruguay, he looked up from the phone and saw the EKG, where the heart trace was jumping above and below the midline, systolic and diastolic as they should be, not irregular, but but faster than he had seen them track before. In the bed, hair frizzed out around the grotesque electro cap, Bibi lay in silence, as she had lain for days. But then abruptly, she groaned in distress. Nancy dropped the newspaper and got to her feet. She reached the bed just as Bibi said, "No, hell, no, no." Waves and tides and far places forgotten, Murph scrambled bedside, the girl between him and Nancy. Her sweet face squinched and her closed eyes closed tighter. "Cannot happen. Will not happen. Is not happening." Leaning over the bed rail, putting a hand on Bibi's shoulder, Nancy said, "Sweetie, do you hear me? Bibi, it's okay. We're here, honey. Daddy and me, both here." "Not happening. Not happening," Bibi insisted. She turned her head from side to side, as though afflicted, denying, resisting. Murph reached for the call button looped to the bed rail, but he hesitated to push it. There was a father-daughter connection that had always been a mystery to him, a knowing without knowing how, knowing when she was safe and when she was not. She could be at the wedge in wicked water, riding mountains, big Quakers 3 times her height, with the very real danger of being swept into the stacked rocks of the breakwater at the harbor's mouth, where surfers had been killed. But he knew that he didn't need to worry. Another time, she might have been with a friend or two, riding bicycles nowhere more dangerous than on the paved boardwalk that served the long peninsula, or in the lightly traveled streets south of Balboa's lower pier. And he phoned her to suggest that she come home or stop by Pet the Cat to keep him company for a while. She'd always heard the vague note of worry in his voice, and she had always done as he asked, and nothing had ever happened to her. But he believed that something might have happened if he hadn't phoned her and changed the pattern of her day. It wasn't as powerful as clairvoyance, this connection, but it was stronger than a hunch. When Bibi groaned again and rolled her head upon the pillow, Nancy moved her hand from the girl's shoulder to her bruised face. "Honey, can you hear me? Will you wake up for your mom? Can you wake up and smile for Daddy and me?" In that way of knowing without knowing how, Murph understood that, as irrational as it seemed, Bibi was safe in the coma, or at least safer than she would be if she woke. The injuries to her face and the tattoo, as mysterious as stigmata, argued against what he felt, but the feeling remained undiminished. In fact, he sensed that the coma was her only hope, that somehow in the coma she had a chance to... to what? Somehow defeat the cancer? The gliomatosis cerebri that no one had ever survived? Was that truly a possibility, or only a father's desperate wish? He watched her eyes twitching rapidly beneath the pale lids, looked at the 5 brainwaves describing their optimal patterns, a phenomenon never before witnessed. And he thought about who Bibi was, the unique girl she had always been. And his desperate wish seemed like a rational hope. Bibi repeated, "Is not happening." Putting a hand to her daughter's brow, which was half covered by the electro cap, Nancy again urged her to wake, to return to them.
"No,"
Murph whispered, but with such force that he startled his wife.
"No, no, no, baby. Let her sleep. She needs to sleep."
Nancy regarded him as if he were the king of kooks, a spleet, a geekamo. "This isn't sleep, Murph. This is a damn hateful cancer coma." Indicating the brainwave readout, he said,
"It isn't a coma. It's something."
Nancy looked from him to the precious girl, to him again. And whatever she saw in his face, his eyes, gave her pause. A blush suffused Murph's brow, his cheeks, a heat not quite like anything he had felt before. Fine beads of perspiration prickled his face, a sweat of awe, if there could be such a thing. His face must be glazed and shining, and he knew that his eyes were. Staring at his daughter, Reassuring his wife, he said,
"She's walking the board."
Chapter 107. By the Skin of Their Teeth. In the Honda, across the street and 20 yards uphill from Solange St. Croix's house, Pogo sat behind the steering wheel, and Pax sat shotgun. Scattered through a rich currency of shadows, gold coins of sunlight shimmered on the windshield.
"Holy moly, Batman," Pogo said. "What would have happened to us if we'd gone up with her to the third floor?"
"I think my SEAL training would have been enough to get me out alive. I'm told you can punch pretty hard with your right."
"Half and half with scotch. Did her mother start her on that in the crib?"
Surveying the large sheets of heavily tinted window glass in the stacked slabs of the house, wondering if he and Pogo were watched in turn by the woman, and if, cat-like, she were licking cream from her lips, Pax said,
"There's something about her that's almost likable. In fact, I feel sorry for her."
Pogo wasn't convinced.
"How does that work?"
"She pretends she's made the life she wanted, but on some level, she knows she got it wrong. She wanted artistic influence, and she got raw power instead. She wanted a literary life, but she got a life of writers' conferences and symposiums and committees pressing for fiction to sell the approved social issues of the moment. Cocktail parties, where networking takes the place of wit. Being targeted by envy blogs. She fancied herself a free spirit, holly-go-lightly, but with a Jane Austen brain. But there's no room at all for free spirits in modern academia, with its speech codes and humorless moralizing. So she makes two lives for herself, or three, for all we know, or four. And in the end, there's no satisfaction in being multiple Solange St. Croix instead of one."
Pogo stared at him. After a moment, Pax said,
"What?"
"I thought you just blew up things."
"I've blown up a lot of things."
Pax looked at his wristwatch, at the dashboard clock, and felt again that time was running out.
"We better get moving."
Starting the engine, Pogo said,
"Well, all I know is, she pushed Biebs out of the riding program and humiliated her in a supermarket that time. And she called her some pretty rank names."
As they drove downhill toward Coast Highway and the commercial heart of Laguna Beach, Pax said,
"Okay, position check. For some reason, we don't know why, Captain gives BB a list of quotations celebrating imagination."
"Yeah, and she reads it so often, she just about wears out the paper."
"So then, Captain dies. BB's 10. She's brokenhearted, deep in mourning. She writes stories about an abandoned dog named Jasper.
Hundreds of pages of stories.
And one day, a dog named Jasper shows up out of the blue."
"Yeah, but she hides his collar with his name on it."
"You're sure she never told you about it?"
"Never did,"
Pogo confirmed, and he turned north on Coast Highway.
"Then she's 17, Pax said. "And she writes about St. Croix's house.
It's a stupid lie that Beebs got a key and went in there."
"Of course. But just by observing St. Croix, by considering the professor's psychology, and by applying her imagination, she got it uncannily right."
"How's that possible?"
"Well, because she's Beebs." "I'm not Watson, and you're for sure not Sherlock."
Pax checked his G-Shock watch again.
"Can you make a little speed?"
As usual, Laguna traffic came to a choke point at Forest Avenue. Pogo said,
"I've souped up this crate, but it doesn't teleport."
Pax said, "Sorry. It's just I think we don't have much time to work this out. We've got to move."
"Move, okay. But where are we going?"
Pax took a deep breath and blew it out.
"I don't know."
Chapter 108, The Enduring Chill. Phoebe parked alongside the highway, certain of being alone in the car. Relatively certain, for the moment. She needed to get to Sonomir Way and find Ashley Bell, but she also needed to regain control of herself. She had been plunging from one untenable situation to another, crisis to crisis, letting events knock her from here to there to anywhere as if she were a pinball. Events could overwhelm anyone. Nobody could stand tall and unmoved in a tsunami. But she could fight the undertow, keep her head above water until the tumult subsided, and then swim. Worse, she had allowed herself to be manipulated. She had taken far too long to recognize that, by one ruse and then another, she was being distracted from her quest. She had invested too much energy and emotion and time, fearing and worrying about responding to things that were no real threat to her. Tapping at a window, scratching at a door, hoodie guy and his dog. The tattoo was a different kind of distraction. Why had she gotten the tattoo? Ashley Bell will live. She didn't need flamboyant displays of dauntless intentions, which wasn't her nature. Quiet perseverance being more her style. Didn't need rah-rah and you-go-girl cheerleading. The tattoo was a challenge, but to whom, to what, if not to fate? And she didn't believe in fate. She was the master of her fate by virtue of free will. In her life, she was fate. Earlier, she had killed the engine. Now she started the car again, but didn't switch on the headlights. She was living in both the present and the past, at least in the sense that occurrences in the past, forgotten, half-remembered, shaped events now. She knew how to cope with the present, how the world of now worked, and how to make her way through it to her best advantage. But she was lousy with the past. When moments of potential revelation arose, she needed to seize them and peel away the thick skin of all those yesterdays to see what fruit waited within. As well, she was living in two worlds. She'd been living in two since Kalida Butterfly began to seek hidden knowledge at the table in the kitchen. The first world was that of cause and effect, reason and design, where truth was discovered by intuition and observation. The second world was far wilder, a place where the supernatural no longer remained behind a veil, to be recognized or not, but frequently burst into view. Within the past hour, Bibi had begun to understand that her past, through the year that she was 10, had been lived in the second and wilder world. From her purse, she extracted the beautiful leather-bound book that had belonged to Kalida, but in which she had seen faint gray lines of her handwriting fluidly flowing and vanishing across the pages. She realized only now that it had been the cursive script of her childhood, much like what she produced these days, though with flourishes she no longer used. Somehow, the book was a link between present and past, also between the two worlds in which she now lived. She turned on the overhead light and opened the magical volume and searched through its blank leaves of creamy paper, but she didn't see the ghostly script this time. The lines of the Donald Justice poem, which she had inscribed on a page and which had vanished, hadn't reappeared. They hadn't been written with disappearing ink, an ordinary pen. So the lines had gone somewhere. Like email, they had gone from one screen to another, one book to another. To regain control of herself, to become again the Bibi Blair that she had been when all of this chaos started, she needed to knit together past and present, as well as the two worlds in which she lived. She didn't know how the book could do that, or if it could do that, but intuition suggested that nothing else at hand could serve that purpose. What good did it do to have a magical book if you didn't in some way use it? Bibi rummaged through her purse and found the pen. Although she sensed the petty god of time in all three of its incarnations, past, present, future, washing away from her, and though near the center of her value system was the admonition to work and achieve, to do for the sake of doing, she put out of her mind the urgency of her quest for the girl. She gave considerable thought to what she should write rather than at once inking words onto the page. As she began each new line, the previous line disappeared from the paper. When she was finished, she watched the last few words fade from view. Although it appeared as if she had done nothing, a sense of accomplishment welled in her, and with it, a fragile hope. She put away the pen in the book, and she shook two capsules from the bottle of Tylenol. Her abraded ear and bruised face ached. The tattoo on her forearm stung in every vertical and horizontal line of its 18 block letters. In the bottle that she had brought from the motel, enough warm Coke remained to wash down the pain reliever. She turned off the interior light, switched on the headlights, and drove back onto the highway. Within seconds, the stern but caring voice of the woman that issued from the GPS began once more to give directions to Sonomir Way, a journey now of less than 10 minutes. To say that the fog returned would be to misrepresent both its origins and the quality of its locomotion. The mist didn't drift in from the west, not from the sea that had birthed the previous clouds, but from the forbidding east, out of the Mojave Desert, where no source of water existed that could have generated such obliterating white masses. The fog came not on little cat feet, per Carl Sandburg, but in a racing flood so dense and swift that Bibi steeled herself for the impact, as if it would have the power of a wall of water, which it didn't. From one instant to the next, the road before her and the landscape around her disappeared, and the headlights were hardly of more use to her than would be the memory of the sun to a coal miner trapped by a cave-in. As she followed the instructions of the GPS, Bibi realized that the woman she had been, the woman she wished to be again, wasn't the woman she should have been. Because she had never integrated within herself some key experiences of her childhood. She had, with the aid of Captain's memory trick, repressed information that would have a profound effect upon the shaping of her character, of her intellect and emotion and will. To be formed even in part by half-truths was to be ill-formed. With this realization, a different kind of chill shivered through her, a peculiar chill like none that she had ever known before. If in the hours ahead she learned the truth of her past, a change would descend upon her, would be forced upon her by new knowledge. And whether or not she saved Ashley Bell, she would never again be the Bibi Blair who had set out on this quest. Part 8. Bibi to Bell. Chapter 109. The Eight-Fingered Waitress and the Possibility of Death. With nowhere else to go, with no leads to be followed at the moment, they went to Pogo's favorite restaurant. The three large sharks hanging from the ceiling were said to have been alive once, not made of plastic or papier-mâché. Preserved by a taxidermist, their skin as glossy as if they were still wet from the sea, swimming one after the other in search of a good meal. Some claimed that an engraved medallion and ruby ring belonging to the legendary and mysteriously vanished surfer, Tommy Cordovan, had been found in the gut of the largest shark. But that was about as credible as another claim that in the same stomach had been found bones DNA matched to the missing aviator Amelia Earhart. The walls were decorated with colorful custom surfboards and photographs of local surf celebrities dating all the way back to the 1930s, guys and more as the years went by, girls, who were largely unknown to the world outside of the Southern California community of devoted boardheads, but who were admired and regarded with affection and sometimes revered as demigods by members of the local beach tribe. People came there for the food, which was good, but as much for the atmosphere, which was saturated with the romance of California as it had once been, and, sadly, would likely never be again. Pax hadn't eaten breakfast, and both he and Pogo had missed lunch. They sat in a corner booth in the welcome quiet before the dinner rush. The waitress who brought menus was in sync with the intensity of the decor, if not with its theme. A well-tanned Amazon with a blonde pageboy haircut,
She stood nearly 6 feet tall, a 40-ish looker who was a version of Nicole Kidman writ large. Her eyes appeared to be blue or green, or maybe blue-gray, depending on the angle at which she regarded you. Uniforms weren't required of the waitstaff, and this woman, her badge identified her as Kanani, which was Hawaiian for a beauty, was dressed in white slacks and a white blouse, accessorized with a red silk sash worn as a belt, and a red and gold silk scarf at her throat. Elaborate dangling gold earrings, flashy bracelets, 8 diamond finger rings. She might have worn 10 rings, except that she had only 8 fingers. Ironically, on each hand, she was missing the ring finger, which was next to the pinky. Kanani smiled and seemed pleasant enough, but there was a remote quality to her, a sense that she held the truest part of herself in reserve, letting the world make of her what it would, which likely had little to do with who she really was. After she had taken their orders for beer and had gone, Pogo said,
"Beebs is fascinated with Kanani. I figure she'll put her in a book someday." "What happened to the fingers?" "Nobody knows. Someone asked her once and wished he hadn't. I wasn't here when it happened, so I don't know if he was a smartass about it or just asking the question was enough to set her off. But Kanani decked him, knocked him out cold."
"And wasn't fired?"
"She's a good waitress. Besides, Wayland Zuckerman, he's the owner, is either head over heels in love with her or terrified of her. Nobody can quite figure out which."
When Kanani brought 2 bottles of Corona, 2 glasses, and napkins, she proved as dexterous as any 10-fingered waitress, and more so than many. Pax and Pogo ordered fish tacos plus a plate of enchiladas suizas with black beans and rice to be split between them.
"Where'd you get the Pogo moniker?" Pax asked.
"Don't have a clue."
"You really don't know? Or the nickname is nobody's business, just like Kanani's missing fingers?"
"I never punched out anyone who asked me. I've been called Pogo as long as I can remember, and no one's ever taken credit for pinning it on me."
"There was a cartoon character way back, in the funny pages."
"Yeah, but I don't think that's where it came from. Everyone in my family's too serious to read the funny pages. And anyway, that was before their time."
Kanani brought their food, and they ate with enthusiasm for a while before Pogo said,
"I don't feel right, scarfing up tacos and beer, while Beebs needs us to be doing something."
"Except there's nothing to do right now. You want to call the AV god and see if he's got the tape recorder working?"
"At least that's something,"
Pogo said, and put down a taco to pick up his smartphone. Earlier, on the way to see Dr. St. Croix in Laguna Beach, they stopped at the house of a guy named Ganesh Patel, a surfer whose passion for designing audio-video systems flowered into a business that he hadn't really wanted, that eventually he had sold for enough money to spend his life beachside. He'd explained that micro-cassette recorders of that type were long out of style, largely replaced by digital systems with greater storage capacity, but that he could fix their example of pathetic Neanderthal technology because he could fix anything. Ganesh answered the call. For a minute or so, Pogo listened, saying only,
"Uh-huh, okay, uh-huh, cool, uh-huh, uh-huh, Laytronic, dude,"
before he terminated the call. Having been around the Blair family long enough to pick up some surfer lingo, Pax knew that Laytronic meant later on, or see you later.
"He's taken it apart. He's got it spread out on his workbench," Pogo said. "Now he just needs to find the kink and put it back together right. Man, when he talks about this stuff, you'd think it was some hot chick he had laid out on that workbench."
"Everyone to his thing. Don't get me talking about the Carl Gustav recoilless rifle.
Is that something that blows things up?"
"Beautifully,"
Pax confirmed. They were nearly finished eating and thinking about a second beer when Pogo said,
"You really think it's a possibility?"
"What is?"
"That wherever Beebs is, I mean, besides the hospital, something could happen and she could die there and die here too."
"She's got brain cancer, Pogo.
Whether or not something really bad happens to her out there in the Twilight Zone, she could die from the glioma.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah, I know.
He looked around at the yellowing photographs of the long-dead surfers, up at the sharks in their motionless but perpetual hunt, as if those familiar sights were new to him, as if the restaurant had become as strange as the surreal angles and metamorphic flow of a dreamscape.
But then, what's going to happen to us if she dies?
After a silence, Pax said,
I don't want to think about it.
Neither do I.
Then we won't.
Finished eating, each of them ordered a second beer. Pax had brought with him the spiral-bound Panther and Gazelle notebook. Now he opened it on the table to skim through some of the Jasper stories, looking for he knew not what, for anything that might be a clue that would help them fulfill Bibi's request. Find me. They were stories written by a 10-year-old girl, but a damn smart 10-year-old. They had flair. They were compelling. Nevertheless, Pax found himself repeatedly turning past the last tale of Jasper to the first two blank pages that followed. On the left-hand page were the two lines from one of Bibi's favorite poems. Now comes the evening of the mind. Here are the fireflies twitching in the blood. He dunked a finger in his beer and wiped it across, Now comes the evening. The black ink smeared readily.
She didn't write this when she was 10. She wrote it recently. I guess within the last month, but maybe not nearly that long ago.
Squeezing a slice of lime over the lip of his beer bottle, Pogo said,
What do you think? Does it mean something?
It has to.
What does it mean?
As Pax was about to admit that he didn't know, words began to appear as if by magic on the right-hand page, in the familiar, elegant, cursive script. Before all of this with Bibi, he had a few times over his 28 years tasted the spice of the uncanny. But suddenly, it was a staple of his diet. Its effects, a chill, a spidery, capering sensation along the nape of the neck, a not unpleasant swelling of the heart, were as reliable as the oral heat and pop sweat that attended the consumption of a habanero pepper. Pogo, too, saw the words appearing. And Pax turned the notebook so that both of them could read the message as it formed. The first line declared, I am a valiant girl. Chapter 110, The Girl in Need of Discipline. On the electronic map, the grid of 16 streets, 8 east-west and 8 north-south, was given no overarching name. But when the GPS announced that a right turn would bring Bibi to Sonomir Way, a monument sign resolved out of the dense fog, a monolith that might have been erected by godlike extraterrestrials to humble and inspire ape-stupid humanity to make something better of itself during the millennia to come. The slab stood about 14 feet high and 7 wide, polished black granite inlaid with a matte-finished stainless steel band surrounding embedded lucite letters that were a luminous blue now at 4 o'clock in the morning. The letters were smaller than might have been expected in those 98 square feet of granite, as if the slab was a shout to get your attention, and the words were a whisper, a name to be spoken only in a respectful hush. Sonomir Technology Park. Cruising slowly, cautiously along the four-lane street, Bibi had an impression of vast properties. Enormous, low-rise buildings, 4 and 5 stories, yet of a scale incomprehensible, were revealed only by landscape lamps, which were in fact security lamps in elegant disguise, floods of pale light frozen in mid-swash, and by scattered ranks of windows where people, or robots, labored in spite of the hour. The architecture was unintelligible in the fog, and perhaps troubling even in clear daylight, inhuman and somehow militaristic,
so that the structures were moored like massive battleships in the sea of mist. No, like starship fleets preparing to venture forth to extinguish not merely cities, but entire planets. 11 Sonomir Way, 100 yards ahead on the left. Bibi pulled at once to the curb, killed the headlights and the engine. She turned off the electronic map and sat in darkness, as the fog invented the many caissons of a ghost army and rolled them slowly through the night. She kept thinking of the bludgeoned man and the gunshot woman in the house from which Ashley Bell had been kidnapped, their broken, bloody bodies. Every injury that she had sustained earlier, in the battle with the brute in the Corona Del Mar bungalow, seemed to ache more than ever. She needed to gather her courage. The one good thing about doing so was that, given how little courage she still had, she didn't waste much time in the gathering of it. She got out of the Honda. The chunk and rattle of the closing door winnowed through the fog, the former traveling not very far, the latter perhaps attracting attention if anyone waited alertly for her arrival. The night pressed white around her, clammy, chilly, fog in her ears, in her throat. Her lungs heavy with inhaled mist, she found the sidewalk and proceeded on foot. Apparently not every property in Sonomir Technology Park had built out, for number 11 was surrounded by a construction fence with a wide double gate, half of which stood open. A metal sign wired to the closed half of the gate declared the future site of Terrazine, Inc. The announced completion date lay less than 14 months away. Therefore, lost in the fog must be considerable construction, perhaps finished wings of a central structure or entire completed buildings. The only light on the property glowed in the windows of one or two large, double-wide construction office trailers. She approached with caution across the unevenly compacted and littered earth, peered in a window, and saw a room containing 6 or 8 office chairs surrounding what appeared to be a dining table-sized scale model of the project. It was a sprawling complex of scalloped and sweeping buildings that seemed about to be airborne, situated among plazas shaded by groves of phoenix palms, enlivened by numerous fountains, as well as by a body of water large enough to be called a lake. Beyond another window lay a room containing 2 large drawing tables, adjustable to various heights and angles, along with support furniture. Architects' elevations and construction schedules were pinned to the corkboard walls. She continued past a dark window to another where light leaked around a drawn blind and painted feathers on the fog. Muffled voices in that room tantalized her, but she couldn't make out what they were saying. Construction crews began early in the day, though not before dawn. Whoever conspired here might be discussing serious issues more pertinent to Bibi than the cost of concrete and the expected delivery date of the next truckload of steel beams. She proceeded to the rear of the double-wide, where another window proved to be covered by a pleated shade. She continued around the corner, hoping that the office extended the width of the trailer and that it might offer a last pane of glass over which no shade had been drawn. In the impossible Mojave fog, 2 parked vehicles were almost fully concealed in mist as thick as mattress batting, one of them an entirely possible Cadillac Escalade, but the other an improbable sedan. Visibility remained so poor that Bibi had almost passed the big car before she recognized the Bentley ornament on the hood. She stepped close to confirm that the paint, when seen in better light, was pale enough to be café au lait. When 2 worlds collided without catastrophe and occupied the same space, a world of cause and effect and an unpredictable world where supernatural wild cards could be thrown onto the table at any time, it seemed inevitable that former teacher and remade woman Marissa Hoflein-Vorschach should be there regardless of the hour. According to the ever-changing rules of this game, of all the real estate developers in California, the one in charge of the Terrazine project could have been no other than the shopaholic's husband.
The most urgent questions now seemed to be where the grandly inflated breasts and the woman behind them were at this moment, and whether Bibi could avoid the crazy bitch. Both were answered when the headlamps of the Bentley flared, dazzling Bibi, and the driver's door opened. She, who had been first to recognize the young rider's talent, exited the sedan, limned by the interior light that flowed out after her and by the backwash of headlamps. As the woman approached, Bibi saw that she was dressed inappropriately for the hour and the place. Stiletto heels, black toreador pants held up with a jeweled belt, a blouse that revealed enough cleavage in which to conceal a litter of kittens, and a white leather jacket with black detailing. The former teacher, a subtle and calculating mistress of mien in the classroom, favored Bibi with an expression that was familiar from days of old, in spite of the extensive makeover of the woman's features. A smug, power-trip smirk. Colored with the inexplicable resentment of someone who, though you never offended her, believed that you were owed revenge. The woman felt now, as always, justified in doling out a real injury for an imagined one, pleased to rain upon her target a storm of petty reprisals. Except that this time, they might not be petty.
"I would ask you, what the hell you think you're doing here?" said Hofline Vorschach. "But I don't care. And you would only lie anyway. Like you lied about having a pistol and about possessing a concealed carry license. You're still the little rebel and liar you always were."
The fog seemed to part for Hofline Vorschach, to vacate a space that she could occupy, as if she and the mist were two magnetic substances whose poles repelled.
"Stop right there," Bibi said. "No closer."
The woman stopped, but only after taking two more steps and forcing Bibi to back away from her.
"Will you ever grow up, Gidget?"
"Don't call me that."
"Why?"
"Because it strikes a nerve."
"Frivolous little Gidget, all about surfing and beach blanket parties and looking cute in a bikini. An even more empty-headed and ridiculous version of your perpetually adolescent parents."
"You don't know anything about my parents. You don't know who they are."
"They came to parent-teacher meetings, didn't they? I knew them at first glance for what they were. And I've always known you're a girl in need of discipline."
Bibi didn't think anyone in the trailer could hear them, but she drew the pistol from her shoulder rig just the same. The former teacher's smile was a mezzaluna of contempt, no less sharp than the crescent-shaped kitchen knife of which it reminded Bibi.
"You're gonna get yourself killed, you stupid girl. Running around in the night, playing Nancy Drew. Or worse than killed. We can take you down and break you down so completely, no one could ever put you together again. And we will."
Chapter 111, Like a Message in a Bottle. The wired sharks in a dead swim overhead. Decades of surfers, fit and tanned, standing tall with their shortboards and longboards, smiling on the walls. And on the table, on the notebook page, five words. "I am a valiant girl."
"This is wild," Pogo said. "But I know what that means."
"Me too."
"Of course, you two. Those books."
"Those books,"
Pax agreed, his mouth gone dry, his heart finding a new rhythm. The next two lines read, "When I saw her yesterday, why didn't I ask Helena Berg if she'd heard of Robert Warren Faulkner? Is he a known neo-Nazi?"
"Either name mean anything to you?" Pogo asked.
"Helena Berg is vaguely familiar, but not the other."
"How could she see this Helena Berg yesterday? She's 4 days in a coma."
"She couldn't have."
The fourth line began to appear, flowed swiftly, and with a concluding question mark read, "Why didn't I ask Helena Berg about Ashley Bell?"
"The name in her tattoo," Pogo said.
For a minute or so, they both watched the notebook, waiting impatiently for a fifth line of script to appear. But then Pogo resorted to his smartphone. Kanani returned to ask if they wanted anything more, and Pax said they didn't, and she left the check. While Pax busied himself with calculating the tip and paying the tab, Pogo said,
"It's not as bad as John Smith or Heather anything, but there are enough Ashley Bells spread around the country to waste more time than we have."
"Try Robert Warren Faulkner."
"Already on it."
Nothing more appeared on the open pages of the notebook. Pax was reluctant to leaf farther back in the volume in search of more deeply buried messages, lest he disturb whatever connection allowed this communication from Bibi in her coma, or from whatever otherwhere she also inhabited. It was as if his girl, adrift on the sea of an alien world, had put a message in a bottle and tossed it overboard, and somehow it had surfaced on the shores of this world. He picked up his Corona, put it down without taking a sip. His fingers were wet with condensation from the bottle. He blotted them on his jeans. He realized that he had grown nervous. He was rarely nervous. Cautious, concerned, alarmed, even afraid, yes, but seldom nervous. He dipped his head back and gazed up at the sharks. He knew how to deal with sharks. It was part of his training. He knew how to deal with the loss of men he fought with, brothers and friends, every one of them.